Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Burning down the house. Yes, it's another Sunday here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Curtis B. Wayne. This Sunday, I want to talk about new towns, collective actions, the development of different ways of life. Not all architects just stick to buildings. In the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, there was a notable pair of architects, William Conklin, and James Rossant. Conklin and Rossant, who not only designed very interesting modern buildings that fit well into their environments, some of which were designated historical districts, which was just starting up there in the 1960s, but also then became urban designers, and they are responsible for those of you here in New York City, for setting the architectural guidelines for the Battery Park Housing Authority down there, Battery Park City. Prior to the construction of the World Trade Center, which started sometime around 1959, there was no Battery Park City. It was all open water. But as they were digging the foundations for the two towers of the World Trade Center, they had to do something with the excavated spoils. That's what we call excavated materials. The spoils were deposited into the river, creating more land for Manhattan. And then there was the determination that it would be nice, actually it would be imperative, the city decided, to have somebody overseeing the development of what would be a great, fantastic new development of real estate. You have to picture that in the 1960s, in the early 1960s, New York was a bit of a desperate place. The gang warfare that we know about from West Side Story, that Lenny Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim musical, was based on real gangs, the Irish gangs and the Puerto Rican gangs in Hell's Kitchen, which we now have euphemized and we call it Clinton. But there were really desperate times in New York City, and so the idea that this new land added to Manhattan should have a character that was carrying forward the best parts of the streetscape of Manhattan Island were entrusted with Conklin and Rossant, and they created the architectural design criteria for Battery Park City. They also created a whole town out of whole cloth down in Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. There was a it was farmland that had a bourbon distillery. I think it was a bourbon distillery. We'll find more about that. And a developer by the name of Simon acquired the land, and they created a town, a whole town with housing and a business district and plazas and all sorts of things that they thought a city should have. And so recently I met our guest today, Dee Dee Malker, who grew up in Reston, Virginia, which was created by Conklin Rossent and Mr. Simon. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Come closer.
Hello.
Yes.
Closer to the mic.
Yes. And so Dee Dee grew up there, and I wanted to have a conversation about what it was like to grow up in a new town. Myself, when I was young, I grew up in a suburban development in a town that seemed very old because it was a suburb of Chicago, where it actually had been a town outside of Chicago before there were suburbs. And it went back to 1843, and everybody thought, wow, that's really ancient. But you grew up in a town, Dee Dee, that started in 1964?
Yes.
When did... 1964. And so I wanted to hear about what you loved about the town, how long you lived there, what it was like growing up as a girl, what your thoughts are some years later about the town. And then if time permits, I would like to talk about your own recent, now that you're no longer in Reston, but you're here in New York City, living in the East Village?
East Village.
Yeah. Your reflections on your Reston upbringing, and then, if time permits, what you're really up to these days. Give you a little free media time. Jack, can we have our first musical break?
They know the whole world and his wife. From a razor's edge to a kitchen knife, they'll be glad to help you.
Curtis B. Wayne here on Burning Down the House with Dee Dee Mocker, who grew up in a town that I hope to hear that you loved it. Grew up in Reston, Virginia, a brand new town that was just created like with modern architecture and plazas and everything. And were you born in Reston?
No, I was born in Washington on Capitol Hill.
And
then we moved out in 68 after the riots because the place was burning up. So my family decided to take us out. My father had it passed by. He'd seen the empty lake and he'd seen some construction. So he looked it up online and said, oh, let's look at this
How
place.
Did he look it up online in 1968?
Yeah,
come on.
He looked it up.
He looked surprised. It up. He asked around. Okay.
So he worked in publishing.
Your father worked in publishing?
Yeah, back in those days.
Okay, well, that's good. So
he was able to look up things online.
So by 1968 or so, I guess the town was really kind of going. It was
no,
a real town?
No, 68, no. Well, it was sort of going. There was probably 5,000 or 10,000 people. I mean,
that's a lot of people.
It was enough to have a little community, yeah.
Right. So were there corner stores?
No corner stores. There was a town plaza. So we would walk to the plaza through the pathways that were sort of like black pathways in Central Park.
Yeah.
So everything was connected via these black pathways.
Okay.
Like the little clusters of homes that were highly compact townhouses that would be, you'd walk through the woods and these little meandering pathways that would take you down to the plaza, which was
center
of town.
So you lived in attached housing.
Yes.
Like
in the boonies, we lived in a townhouse.
Did you have trees? I mean, was it planted up?
Yeah. Yeah, no, they didn't actually just raise the ground. They tried to save as many trees as possible, so there were lots of trees that were there. Even in the if you first moved in, there were trees there.
Even though it had previously been some kind of farm?
No, well, it was a cattle farm, so they had trees. It wasn't just vast open space.
And
there's rolling hills and trees and woods. And
I have to admit, I've never been there. It's
oh no.
have been to Radburn, and Radburn, New Jersey,
yeah,
I understand it was like a precursor to the planning ideas.
Definitely. That's where Mr. Simon's father worked on that. Robert E. Simon Sr. worked on Radburn, or was part of the Radburn development financially.
So Junior did Reston.
Yeah. Well, his father died when he was 21.
Ouch.
And he inherited Carnegie Hall and 181 properties that were in foreclosure during the Depression. But he always looked to his father and as a mentor, I guess, and remembered growing up and learning about Radburn and, I suppose, wanted to build a town of his own.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, sure. All of us just want to build a town. No, actually, I don't know. Do you?
Yeah.
No, I'm not so sure. I mean, that's a big responsibility.
Yeah. Well, someone's got to take it on.
So, after Radburn, did you live in other suburban places?
I never lived in Radburn.
Oh, I'm sorry. Reston. Got my
R's.
No,
I've only lived in Reston, and then I went to college, and
wow.
Then I came to New York.
So
Reston was sort of normal. I'd traveled around, of course, and been to Europe and been around the country in different places, but I haven't lived, before that, I hadn't lived anywhere else.
Except in Washington.
When I was 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Okay, so, yeah, well, we won't hold you accountable for memories of when you were 4. Some of us who lived in suburbia, you know, rode our bikes to school and and walked to school and things like that. And, you know, the mom stayed home and drove to the grocery store. How much of that would you say was indicative of your upbringing? I mean, did your mom have to drive to the grocery store?
She didn't have to, but she could if she wanted to.
Okay. Well,
she's a real estate agent, so she probably did have her car with her because people would come in and she'd drive them to the houses to see the houses.
Right.
But I was always able to walk down to the center, and I always came back with groceries. And.
But this center, looking at pictures of it, I mean, it's fairly densely built up. I mean, it's actually, I think, you've been to Battery Park City, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
It's kind of like that, right? It's kind of dense. High-rise buildings, mid-rise buildings?
One high-rise.
One high-rise.
He wanted to do more high-rises, but he ran out of money. He actually used the PR budget to build the Heron House, which is the high-rise that's there now.
And so the other buildings are about how high? 2 or 3 stories?
Yeah, he didn't want anything one story. He made sure everything was at least 2 or 3 or more.
Oh, I endorse that.
They're sort of, I guess they're 3 stories. So you have the shops on the base floor,
mm-hmm.
and then you have the condos above them are kind of duplex with upstairs,
uh-huh.
cathedral ceilings with upstairs. Very nice, overlooking the lake.
Which lake is that?
Lake Ann.
Was that an artificial lake?
It was. He had actually filled the valley with water, but he took out the nice trees before he did that.
And replanted them?
There are 2 types of trees he took out. They took out because they didn't, I guess they were.
Well, it upsets people when they see a lake with trees sticking out of it, I suppose.
Yeah, they were little, like, I don't know, holly trees or something. I can't remember what it was.
So was there any?
But it was just a little creek that you could stand over. It was tiny, and so they flooded it and filled it with water.
Okay. And so, but you had everything. I mean, there were schools.
Yep, the school behind me. We walked to school.
And a high school?
There wasn't a high school at first, so we all went to the high school in Herndon, which for my brother and some other people kind of was hard because they got picked on and beat up.
Because they weren't from there?
I guess so. I mean, we were different people from the people in Herndon, maybe. I don't know.
How far is that?
10 minutes.
Like next door?
Yeah.
So you got,
I didn't have a problem there, but I guess he did.
So they were bused there?
We took a bus to high school.
Uh-huh.
And junior high. But there was an elementary school right behind my house.
But, okay, so so someone, Mr. Simon, comes along and decides he wants to make it a city. I mean, now it's like 50,000 people or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like on the edge of what we call an edge city, which is not quite suburban, but it's an urbanistic place on its own terms, mm-hmm. with its own businesses, but that has access to a major urban center like Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So Reston is considered one of these edge cities. White Plains, New York is an edge city. I can't think of any in New Jersey. Oh, Newark would be, but Newark was always a city from way back. Mm-hmm. So Reston is an edge city. Did your father work in Reston?
No, I guess the concept was live, work, play, but not everyone right. at the time could get jobs in Reston because there weren't that many that had been attracted there yet. A
right.
lot of people were attracted to start businesses there because they had a no tax policy for those new
excellent.
Businesses. Yeah, so but not enough at the time. So a lot of people still worked in Washington, a lot of CIA people and
CIA. Okay. Yeah, well, they were commuters. They had to commute to you know, all the spy novels, and now I can't remember where CIA and McLean or something.
I wasn't really, that was the,
so
the parents.
What I'm after in terms of a dialogue that's appropriate to architecture and the built environment, did you have a lot of nature in this town? I mean, you talked about trees and paths and a meandering creek. And I mean, did it feel like being in the country? I mean, you're looking, I mean, I'm supposing you've spent some time in the country since then.
Yeah.
Was it country-like or was it really
it wasn't
rather dense?
Rural. I mean, it felt, I mean, for me as a kid, it was fine. We were playing in the woods all the time. We spent most of our time in the woods playing. Or there's also a front area between the houses that was a concrete area that we played on. There was planters and there was a lot of steps and there was a big open space. There was a garage with an open space above the garage that we played on. It was actually a play. It was completely open. There wasn't a planter or anything on it, so it was great for kickball or something.
All right.
There's a lot of open, completely open spaces to play, but as well as lots of nature to play in.
That sounds
lots of cemented area and also lots of nature.
That sounds all right. My own suburban area when I was a boy was houses, and the front yards were kind of useless because they were rather narrow, and there were mm-hmm. sidewalks and roads, and then mm-hmm. the backyards. We mostly went to on our bicycles to parks that hadn't been developed yet. It was accidental parkland for us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Over time, that all got built up. I'm sad for the people who came after us because it was a nice balance of development and then undeveloped land.
Yeah.
So
I wonder if that'll happen in the future because they're going to start maybe building in higher density. I mean, it was all pre-planned, so I don't know if they would take the land between the cluster. I was in Hickory 3, and there's Hickory 2 and 1. There was all this. There was a little pond and a volleyball court and a pathway and a play area. So it all kind of mixed with trees. I'm not sure they would put housing there. Maybe it's too wet. They also didn't build around the streams. So if you look at the map, you can see that all the streams are available for pathways and nature walks. And
they're still protected. Yeah,
yeah,
that's good.
I mean, they're not healthy right now, but they're protected.
Not healthy how?
I mean, well, they're trying to revitalize the stream system. They actually got money from the county and they're revitalizing them.
Or they silted up or something?
Because of the stormwater system that was built in the 60s.
That
all the water is
goes into the
straight into the very quickly all this water from the development goes straight into the little streams and ruins them.
Yeah, well, that's that's a thread that we look at in architecture. In individual buildings right now is even in New York City, you have to slow down the flow of stormwater from the roofs of a building mm-hmm. before they go into the sewer system. And to the extent that we can hold the water with vegetative roots, you know about this?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's law now.
That wasn't the case in the 60s.
Right. You could always retrofit those buildings, I suppose.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And they're starting to do it.
And encourage water to discharge
definitely.
Down into the aquifer instead of into the creek.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole Lake Ann area, the lake is actually a watershed. So everything around it flows into the lake. Anyway, it's a watershed.
That's good. And they left the natural. Well, but it's not natural because Lake Ann was artificial.
Mm-hmm. Some streams, natural springs. But
right. So it became an enhanced waterway.
Yeah. It's kind of polluted now.
Let's take a little break and come back and talk a little bit more about Reston.
And you know the sun's setting fast, and just like they say, nothing good ever lasts. Well, go on now and kiss it goodbye, but hold on to your lover, 'cause your heart's bound to die. Go on now and say goodbye to our town, to our town. Can't you see the sun setting down on our town, on our town? Good night. That's where I met my baby on one hot summer night. He was the tender and the order to bear. It's been 40 years and I'm still sitting here.
Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market. Whether you are cooking for one or for a crowd, Fairway Market literally has everything you need for a fantastic meal. But if you don't feel like cooking, no worries, they cater. Check out fairwaymarket.com for more information, and be sure to check the new blog, On Our Plate, for weekly specials, health tips, and recipes.
Burning Down the House with Dee Dee Mockert, talking about her old town, Reston, Virginia. So, if you compare your experience at Reston with other places that you've lived, what would you have done if you were the planner, with hindsight, perfect hindsight, to make it a better place? More shops, more corner shops.
I guess once you get past a child in Reston, at least in the early days, I mean, I'm only talking about early Reston. I don't know anything about new Reston. It could be completely different. But early Reston, where Lake Ann Plaza is, and the just the local community around there. I remember it was, you know, once you're in high school, it's a little boring. So maybe I would bring more activities for teens and young people. What we were missing was a college.
Yep.
And they knew that at the time. They knew that they wanted to have a college there, but I don't think it was ever possible. And they've maybe have a campus of one of the schools now, but at the time there wasn't really that edgy young culture.
But as a teenager, you really couldn't get into D.C. without hitching.
So you would go to Georgetown, which is a
but you couldn't
drive.
Get, yeah, you had to drive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't connected by the rail. Which
it's like 20 or 25 minutes,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, as a drive. It's not really
nearby.
Yeah,
we were kind of in a bubble.
Yeah.
I lived in this little bubble when I grew up.
And that's one of the underlying...
which is fine. Yeah.
Well, when you're young to live in a bubble, really young,
yeah,
that's fine. When you're a teenager,
yeah. Yeah.
It would be great to be able to hop on a bus or yeah. get on the train mm-hmm. or, in my case, I could get on a bus and take a 10-minute ride and get on mm-hmm. a train and go into New York City.
Right. Well, now they have the town center, which has a lot of entertainment.
You mean like a movie theater?
It's sort of like an outdoor shopping mall.
Ugh.
So it's not...
Well, that's like everywhere else in New York.
Franchises.
Outside of New York.
It gives people a place to go.
Well, that has become the American paradigm, where the shopping mall is the town center, and that's what you do for mm-hmm. fun. You go to the mall.
So at least this one's outside, at least. So you have fresh air.
It's great if it's not raining or snowing.
A lot of high-rises to make you feel urban.
Right. But do they have like a movie theater there?
They do.
Oh, that's good. Right.
And a skating rink.
Yeah, but there's...
We used to skate on the lake, though.
It would freeze up?
Yeah, that was
fun. All right.
Fun.
I suppose with global warming, that's not happening anymore, unless they put chiller coils in there to freeze
fun.
It up. Well, that'd be great, yeah.
Good idea.
The EPA would have a fit if you did that.
Yeah.
So, in terms of how that informed or directed what you did later in life, would you say that your life after that is in any way sympathetic to growing up in a town like that?
I do graphic design as well, and I was told my design seems to have a structure, but it's not visible. So the sort of Reston was planned with the curves of the terrain.
Yeah.
It wasn't put in a grid on top of the land. They took the land in consideration and nature and the flow of the water and the curves of the topography. So everything was curved and placed in position according to.
So you think that your graphic design, perhaps, in some way,
my spatial relationships, I think,
is more geocentric.
Hopefully, yeah.
I mean, I know that's a big word or something like that. So how long?
And maybe the way I relate with people, I have a lot of connectivity, like connecting, the way I connect to things in my arts about connectivity. So.
Well, I suppose
the tensions between people, the connections.
Yeah, you could have that in a city, but.
Well, yeah.
But having
but
both.
But I lived in the suburbs. I lived in the boonies. It was the country. There was nothing there.
But it was country. But it was instant country.
They were trying to create a mini New York.
What I'm trying to.
A little Central Park with a little Carnegie Hall with a little.
Well, that's good.
You know, Mr. Simon used to own Carnegie Hall, so there's a lot of that. He actually left in 1967, so the rest of Reston after that was built by other people.
Uh-huh.
So the early Lake Yan area was the only part that he really had his hands in.
Mm-hmm.
So I can speak to that.
He had to leave. He had to get lost his shirt.
Not enough people bought into the property. Yeah.
And he had to sell out.
He sold to Gulf Land Development Corporation.
Is that related to Gulf Oil?
Yes.
Ouch. Mm-hmm.
And then they sold the Mobil, and then they sold the Terra Brook.
Wow. And did it change?
I suppose it's going on.
But you moved there after he was out of the picture.
Yeah, so he wasn't there. I didn't know who he was. Yeah. I just heard that his name was in the name of Reston, so it was R-E-S Town, Robert E. Simon Town.
I was going to ask you about.
Yeah.
Oh, that's.
And I didn't know that until we were driving down this road called Temporary Road, and somebody mentioned it because we were passing his house, which no one ever lived in. We thought it was abandoned. It's just this big white house behind the trees, and which was different from all the other houses because everything else was modern and townhouses, and this was an old white house, you know, like a.
Had that been there before?
It'd been there
from
the previous owners of the land.
Or when it was a farm. With the distillery.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very near the distillery, actually.
Uh-huh.
So, Virginia Gentleman. Virginia Gentleman.
Uh-huh. It was a sort of a...
That was the distillery. The brand.
Oh, it was called Virginia Gentleman?
That's the brand, yeah.
Uh-huh. Because they have samplings for...
I didn't have any. No. Yeah. I think it's gone. It's moved somewhere else.
Yeah. But now I understand that you've been working perhaps on a film about Mr. Simon.
I interviewed Mr. Simon in 2007 and 2008 because I was interested in his story and why did he build this town? And I didn't really think of him since that one time I realized that his name was in the town and it sort of disappeared from my mind. And then I heard he was actually living in Reston in the Heron House, which is the high rise he built.
Not in his old white colonial...
Which is still there, the Bowman House. Yeah, it's still there. It's office space now, unfortunately.
So he was living in a high-rise in the town that he built.
Now he's living on the 13th floor of the high-rise.
Yeah, well, that's a lucky number.
Why are there... he actually decided the Restonians wouldn't be superstitious. So, and he didn't know he was going to live there. He never knew that he was going to end up living in the town. But he decided to go back because that's where community is, or he felt his community was there.
And so he must be incredibly old.
He's 97 right now.
Wow.
He's going to be 98 on April 12th. And he's telling the story of his life at the Reston Museum, I think, during that week sometime in April.
In April. Are you going to be there?
I might go, yeah.
Yeah, with your.
I'll be in D.C.
With your film crew?
Yeah, Friday the 13th.
That's another.
No, not with my film crew. He's speaking at the museum for whoever wants to come.
Uh-huh.
About his family.
About his family.
Mm.
That's nice. Does he have descendants?
He has a daughter and a stepdaughter who has a family in Reston.
So there's not like a Simon line that will go on. Not
I don't
less,
know if his daughter has
his
children.
Daughter.
Maybe
yeah.
She does.
So it's not like
he... And well, he has other sisters and brothers who passed away. I don't know the details of their families.
Yeah, okay.
There's probably Simons around.
Well, let's get out of this place and then come around after the next brief musical break. Talk about what you're up to today.
Okay. In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, yeah, people tell me there ain't no use in trying, yeah. Now my girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, yeah, you'll be dead before your time is due.
Dede Mocker, talking about her experience of growing up in a brand new town, Reston, Virginia. You had some other things. You feel that you didn't really answer it. What was it like? I mean, was it good?
Yeah, it was great. I enjoyed it.
When
yes,
you went to college, were you glad to leave? Or when you went
yes.
away to school?
Yes, I was. I was glad to leave. I mean, I was glad because at that time, it wasn't, like I said, for a person in their teens, it wasn't that interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Or so as a child, though, it was really wonderful because I had access to my mother who worked down in the center, and my friend's parents actually worked down there also. We had tons of kids everywhere and lots of places to play, so we were free.
Yeah, that's a nice aspect of
we're free and safe. I
yeah,
think.
Of a traditional town where the kids can just do the kid things
yeah.
without having to have their parents with eternal vigilance, worrying about weirdos with their kids.
Right. Well, there's always weirdos.
Well, they were different weirdos then.
We were pretty safe. So, and then we had the pool across the street. I had a Olympic sized pool at my. You know, across the street from me, where I had tons of friends that we could meet there every day. I had tennis courts if I wanted to start playing tennis. And we had a lake that we could go swimming and playing in. We spent a lot of time in the lake swimming. So we had both. We had sort of this country club life if we wanted, swimming pools and tennis courts or golf courses. Or we could do the nature thing and play with mud balls and ha ha ha, speaking of.
Well, what about... So lately, I understand that you've been playing with mud a lot, which
right.
is dear to the hearts of all the urban farmers who are affiliated one way or the other with Heritage Radio Network.
Right.
So now you're a professional mud
baller.
Specialist.
Muddy.
Mud baller.
Right. So I was introduced to Shig Matsukawa, I hope I got his name right, who works at this 12th Street Community Garden, and he's working with effective microorganisms. And
effective microorganisms.
Yes.
Are there ineffective microorganisms?
Right. There's beneficial and non-beneficial, the ones that make you sick. So in the beneficial microorganisms, you have lactis bacilli, yeast, phototrophic bacterias that are in this one solution that are all food-based.
What and solution?
They're EM, it's called.
Uh-huh. And who invented EM?
The EMRO, the Effective Microorganism Research Organization.
Are they a Japanese
Japan,
thing?
Yes.
Okay.
So Effective Microorganism Research Organization, Japan.com. So you can learn more about the effective microorganisms. And we're using them to ferment our food waste. And also Shiga's at the community garden teaching people how to ferment their food waste instead of using... a composting thermophilic method. He's using this method where you actually ferment your food waste in a closed container in your kitchen for 2 weeks, and then you bring it to the garden. Or you just bring it to the garden, and the garden will add the microbes to it. and so, it's closed for 2 weeks, and then it's fermented.
Okay, so back up. So thermophilic, is that how most...
That's a heat processing.
Is that how most ordinary compost happens?
A lot of compost, yeah. It's a putrefaction process, and it heats in this pile. So this is actually... You can actually put the microorganism bokashi, they call it. Bokashi means fermented food waste in Japanese.
Okay.
And so that's how it's referred to as bokashi.
B-O-K-A-S-H-I. Okay, bokashi. And so bokashi goes into being mixed with earth?
Right, so you can take the... Right, and then it turns into soil. And this is really good for fertilizer for farms or agriculture. And also you can take the goo that's at the bottom of the pot, or I mean the container that you have, and that is also fertilizer. If you mix it 1 to 100 with water, you can spray it onto the soil of your plants to keep bugs and nutrition
so you
into
said,
the soil.
So you're telling me that if I had a container, you know, in my apartment, and I did this... eutrophic or something?
No.
Okay, it's not heat generated. It's
anaerobic.
Yeah, it's anaerobic.
It's in a closed container.
Okay, so there's not air, so
you can get
it would
one
be
of those
anaerobic
container store things that keep out the air for your dog food or for your cookies. And I put my food waste in there, and then I sprinkle the fermented starter, which has the microbes already fermented in it, on top of the food. And then every time I add to it, I add some of this bran. And then it's done. In 2 weeks, I have fermented food waste that I can either trench in the ground, like a foot in the ground, which will help my soil build really rich soil, or I can sandwich it in pots.
And it doesn't smell bad.
It smells a little light, vinegary. Depends on also if I had citrus in one. It was very orangey smelling.
Is it like other composting where you're supposed to keep meat wastes out of it?
You can put meat in this. Meat, anything. Meat, eggs,
really?
Dairy, rice, pasta. I mean, you can put it all in. Bread.
So if I had one of these containers in my kitchen, and after a couple of weeks, I could spread it on geraniums on the windowsill.
You wouldn't spread it. You'd put it inside
you have
the dirt.
To dig it in?
Yeah. You dig it into the middle just a little bit. Uh-huh. You can take a little bit and spread it in like butter, you know, or like thick jam. I don't know. And then you put the dirt on top.
Uh-huh.
And then you have to wait 2 weeks before you put the roots into the soil. Or if you're just doing seeds, you can put the seeds in right away. But if you're going to put plants with roots, you want to wait till the soil turns, the compost, the fermented food waste, turns into soil.
Do you know anything about the, you know, like the background of this, you know, EM movement? Did it come out of some sort of crisis in Japan? Is it in?
Well, Dr. Higa in the 60s is a professor.
Dr. Higa
started it, and he got sick selling agricultural products, and he decided he should make something that wouldn't make him sick or anybody. So he started talking to people, and he found somebody was using a microorganism or a bacteria for a tangerine that worked. So he started testing each bacteria one at a time, and nothing worked. So he'd throw it out in this other bucket. So that didn't work. He'd throw it in the bucket hundreds later, you know, bacteria, and they all didn't work. So he'd throw them away. And then before he went away on vacation, he threw the bucket in the backyard. So when he came back 3 weeks later, this was like a lush backyard, and he said, "Did anybody pour anything here?" And everyone said no. And he said, "So it was what I poured, all the wasted product work together as a whole." And so he started researching that, like how are they working together better than working alone. So he came up with, you know, he just used all the food-based bacteria, and he came up with a solution of 8 that work together and are all food-based and beneficial for agriculture. So they work to...
That's good.
Well, remediate the soil and nourish the soil.
Well, the reason that I'm asking is that as I made in my little tiny speech at the Heritage Radio Network fundraiser last week, I don't see that you can separate the built environment, which is why I wanted to talk about rest in a little bit, which is that if you were given a a clean slate of terrain and you were going to make a city, how much nature, how little nature? And then the next step these days is people becoming aware that the quality of the soil and the quality of the food that comes from the soil starts to become a placemaker in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And then the next step to expostulate is that it may well be that the future of agriculture will rely a great deal on seed sharing in urban farms that are not exposed to the depredations of infection from genetically modified seed out in the big ag terrain in the middle of the country.
Right. So when I took a permaculture course with Andrew Faust, and at that end of course, I did a plan for Reston for the Lake Ann Plaza. And the Lake Ann Plaza, I decided to work on that because it's not doing as well as it did when I grew up there. We didn't have competition, so everybody shopped at the plaza. Now the big box movement took the grocery store away from the plaza, and the plaza lost a lot of people. Yeah. So they don't really have to go there anymore. They go there because they want to, but they don't have to. And that was part of what made it wonderful, is that people had to go there, and we had to run into each other, and we had to, be together because we had to go there, and we ran into each other. So now there's no grocery store. That doesn't happen as much. And I decided to do a permaculture plan on it. And it was based with the watershed. So I started with the watershed, daylighting the streams, which are already polluting the water. And so once the lake was clean with good fish, we could start fishing, right? Now we have food. Now we have restaurants that could serve this fresh fish.
Wow.
And so we have a foodie environment growing, and we can start growing food on the roofs, and we could start catching our water. So we keep cleaning the river, and we have water, fresh water. We become more independent. We have our own water. We have clean water. We have our own fish. We start growing our own food. And we start micro enterprises exchanging these products and making added value products.
Yes.
So here's this little community that could really revitalize through just cleaning the watershed.
And it really builds a sense of place.
Yeah. And then people get involved, and they're in love with the community.
I don't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, no,
I'm just so full of
so
questions.
So excited.
I don't know the term permaculture. What does that mean?
Permanent culture that was created in 1972 by Bill Mollison and that's the other guy. In California, Berkeley, I think. And it's been catching on lately with all of the things that we're doing with food and farming. It's really more conceptual. I learned from a conceptual perspective because he's teaching in a class in the East Village. He also teaches out in his farm in the Catskills this summer. He'll be doing that. But I took a class where we were in a classroom. We did a little bit of hands-on, a little bit of touring around, but mostly it was concept, which was great because we could all take it into a lot of people take these concepts into business. And there's a lot of little businesses that are growing out of the students.
Do you know about the Manhattan Project?
Yes, we use that in our analysis.
Is this analogous to the notion of the Manhattan Project, which, for those of you who live outside of New York City, you might not know about it, which was an intensive research into trying to discern what before... European people came
1607.
To right before Hendrik Hudson arrived. What were the native plants and animals, and what was the terrain really like? Mm-hmm. And they've mapped it, and you can look at this interactive map.
Right.
And I don't know how they actually were so sure about all of that.
Yeah, it's
but
close
it's
enough.
An interesting idea. Yeah. There's a lot of geological information that has been accumulated to map out all of the tiny little streams that were in Manhattan Island, which we run into when we build buildings, sometimes to our detriment. I know a project on West 15th Street where the historical data indicated that there had been a stream running through a particular site, but it was at the time that they did soil borings, it was dry. It had been a dry spring.
Right.
And they decided to put pilings through the silt on the site using high-pressure water to water jet through.
Right.
And the water didn't go down. It went sideways through the dry stream bed that they hit.
Right.
And it blew out the foundation of the adjacent building. Well, they were...
So if you know that, if you look at the Manhattan Project, you can
right.
see why this is happening. And if you
right.
looked at that before you did the architecture,
right.
you might have be able to prevent that. So every time we do
exactly.
a site design, we look at the Manhattan Project to make
right.
sure, okay, here we have...
Exactly.
This used to be a marsh. This used to be very wet. So let's plan for a very wet environment.
Right.
Or let's bring back the marsh and allow, which I did in the 6th Street Community Center plan for the DEP I was applying for. We looked at the Manhattan Project. We saw that there was a stream coming through, and we saw this used to be a marsh. So, like, let's put sort of a marsh environment back here.
Yeah.
So, because there is a lot of water, what are we going to do with it?
Right, exactly.
A marsh used to do a really good job with this water.
Right.
So let's put something like that back.
Right. One of the largest buildings in Manhattan is 108th Avenue. It's a Port Authority building.
Yeah.
You know that huge, big building? And I work in the same office space as Terrapin Bright Green, and they've been hired by Google, which is taking over that building, to work with the permaculture of that site.
Awesome.
And they've discovered that there's a river running, a really very big water course that runs under that site. And they're just working on how to use all of that water
right.
to naturally cool the building.
Right.
And
See,
that
perfect.
All comes out of the Manhattan Project.
I know. It's amazing.
And,
thank you, Manhattan.
Yeah, and it's it's working with nature
uh-huh.
In terms of making the built environment better. I mean,
uh-huh.
the goal is for that huge, big building, which has a uh-huh. million-plus square feet.
Right.
It's a massive. It's a whole city block.
Mm-hmm.
To not use any artificial cooling. Just
mm-hmm.
some electricity.
Well, that's what we did in Reston, too, in the 60s. They had the lake was cooling all the houses.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's very advanced.
And in my permaculture plan, I actually made the water in the pool that's above the little part of the lake where it's used to cool water, the little
uh-huh.
marina.
Uh-huh.
I made it fresh water. So the water is always flowing through the pool because it's coming down from a hill. I collect it in cisterns and it goes into the pool. And the baby pool has a lot of pee in it so that it helps nutrient it. That helps the plants on the side of the pool.
Uh-huh.
And then it goes into a rain garden, and then it flows into the pool, I mean, into the marina, which needs more water constantly over the summer because people need to have their apartments cooled
uh-huh.
with this lake water. But it's also competing with the golf course. Apparently, the golf course is also using the same lake water.
Of course.
So there's a competition in the summer for golf course or air conditioning. So now if you use my plan with the pool constantly draining into the lake, you won't have a problem.
That's good. Well, nature has a way of waking us up and letting us know.
Exciting. Everything's easy once you listen to
when we're not paying attention. Let's have our next musical break and let it roll all the way out. Thank you.
Saving you.
burning down the house. It is nature's way to let us know when we're not doing things right.
Yeah. I'm going to burn down your house.
Lightning does happen. Back in the 1960s when that song was written, when I was just a wee lad, the environment was terrible. Air quality in New York City was atrocious. You could cut it with a knife. There were days when they got on the radio and told people don't go out because the air pollution was so bad. And the Hudson River was close to being dead.
When was this?
Up until the beginning of the EPA in the early 1970s.
Oh. I came in the mid-70s and it was disgusting.
It was really
bad. I would never live here. Here I am.
Oh. Yeah. The air quality has been slowly improving, and we have to be very thankful for that. Yeah. So you were saying there are a lot of people who really haven't had the Reston experience, even though they live there, because it's become a bedroom community because of the Dulles.
Oh, now. Yeah, I don't know about now, but I just know
way.
There aren't a lot of communities like Reston, so how can you experience what it was like to live in early Reston? I think living in early Reston is different from living in Reston now, so I don't, but I can't really speak to that because I don't
live there. But experimental things are always that way. Mm-hmm. On Friday, I met Martin Ping, who I hope, I expect will eventually be a guest with us here on Burning Down the House. He's the executive servant of the Hudson Valley Collaborative up in Columbia County. And it's a farm-based community, but they have all sorts of things happening. They have a regional processing center for farmers to bring in their produce and flash freeze them and things like that. But it's food based, but it's also ethical, and it's also a little bit metaphysical, because their farming is based on the biodynamic principles set forth by Rudolf Steiner. And I asked him about the preparations that they use, which involves grinding up quartz crystal and spreading it through the soil.
It's a passion. Right.
And he said, yeah, well, you know, it's true that scientists come and they visit and they can't figure out why it works, but it does work. And so, again, that's another food-based community organization. I mean, because all towns that have any sort of life are either on a river for fishing or shipping, commerce, or they're in a rich agricultural area. In the case of Reston, it was an instant city, but then on the other hand, and therefore, but it had intentionally, because of Conklin and Bressant, it had natural features so as to be a good place to live.
Right. It wasn't instant, because there was the facilities were there, but there was no one in them. So if you wanted to do something like start a soccer team, you had to do it, or a theater company, you had to make the theater company. So yes, a lot of people were really participating.
Well, that's pretty instant compared with New York City, New York town starting in the 1600s. And by the time of the American Revolution, there were only 25,000 people living down at the tip of Manhattan Island, which is a lot of people, but not that much. I mean, it took 170 years to get, you know, 25,000 people. So it's incremental. So that there are 50 or 60,000 people in Reston now, 40 years later, is pretty good.
Right. But it's kind of set up now, and they don't have to participate as much if they don't want to.
Ah, you could just live there.
Because everything's there.
Things are instituted. Well, yeah. But that is the nature of human community. You know, we set things up, and then more people join, and then it's there, and then the people who come later take it for granted, and in 30 years people will take it for granted that, you know, that Roberta's farm next here, you know, is... They'll start building floors above the lot, you know, and Heritage Radio Network, and In 2043, we'll be broadcasting from the top of the 40th story of Roberta's farm or something like that.
Right.
And Jack will be the chairman of Heritage Radio Network.
Come back, come back. You've gone off. You're going to go into like 2050.
Maybe Jack doesn't want that job.
Okay, back to today.
I'll take a role on the board at that point.
That's good. That's good. I think that's only appropriate. Chairman Emeritus. And by then you'll be like, I don't know, 30 years old, right?
Yes, 30 on the dot.
Yes. Any last words you'd like to talk about Bokashi and mud balls and any upcoming make your own mud ball events?
Yeah, there's a bunch there on my website. You can check my website.
And what is that?
moscollective.net.
Masters of Succession.
Yeah. I got that from the Master Composter course that they had. I thought that was so funny. You could be a master of compost. So I thought, how about master of everything? Master of Succession. Master of everything always getting better. And
yeah, well, Succession...
We're inherently making the world better.
If you think in Darwinian terms, then it's like, okay, well, we could be replaced. And, you know, then you get into, like, a weird head, like, oh, my God, the machines could take over. And we'd end up being copper tops like in The Matrix. And... Okay. Or maybe our cats take over. I don't know.
All right.
You can't remember any events coming up?
I mean,
some people
celebration
do listen
at
to this
the,
program. Yes.
The seed celebration is coming up on April 21st.
Seed celebration.
At the Old Stone House in Brooklyn.
Where's that?
And we'll be doing Bokashi and Mudball. I'd like to do a Mudball campaign for... Or I'm doing a Kickstarter, not a Kickstarter, an In Your Own Backyard, IOBY.org. Fundraiser for the Gowanus Canal, trying to clean the Gowanus Canal with mud balls.
Yeah.
Which is the fermented...
You think that would work?
The fermented microorganisms in the mud ball. They've done it in many other places around the world, so why not... Why wouldn't it work here?
Well, as I understand it, one of the reasons that the Gowanus Canal is really so polluted is because there were coal gas plants along the Gowanus, and
right.
So it's the petrochemical residue of coal that's become
sediment.
Well,
we could
sediment.
Try it. You have
why
to do a lot.
It?
I mean, it worked in Penang Bay, and that's a huge bay, and now it's like emergency use water only, which is great change from a bunch of like feet of sludge.
Wow.
So, I mean, it went from just a big sludgy bay to...
Penang in Philippines?
Yeah, Malaysia. That's one of many places that have used the mud balls, and they've discovered now that you can just throw as many as you want in. It's just going to be good. So once the pollution is gone, the microbes have nothing to eat, so they go dormant.
Until there's more stuff to eat.
Yeah, then they...
But because they're beneficial, you don't have to worry about
good.
Them.
It's yeah.
It's like acidophilus in your yogurt.
It doesn't have acidophilus in it, but it brings it in because maybe acidophilus isn't that dominant, so they didn't add it into the solution. But it does come when you put it in.
Excellent. Well, in April, I hope to have some of the participants, including Kate Bakewell, whom you know, and Claire Harton, who's a friend of the station, and Carolyn Steele.
Mm.
They're having a symposium about placemaking as a response to Food Source, which Kate Bakewell is hosting and has organized, and we'll be back here. God willing, in the studio to talk about that in advance of their symposium. And I hope that you would come and join us in asking them really good questions.
Ooh.
And talking about how do we develop that awareness throughout the land. Carolyn's an architect, and Kate's a landscape architect, and Claire is a foodie, and she's a good friend of Jimmy Carbone, the host of Beer Sessions here on Heritage Radio Network. So we're all on the cusp of this emerging understanding that you cannot separate the built environment from the growing environment. It's all creative, and it's all good. It's like beer. It just sudses up, and ideas whiz around, and...
It's like fermentation. Beer,
yes.
Right?
That's right. We're fermenting good ideas here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne with Dee Dee Mocker. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.